First of all, before we even begin today, I want to apologize for having an iPad here.
Yes.
Because
you
this
look,
is...
You look sad. You look pathetic.
I feel emasculated.
You look weak.
I hate my iPad. I hate having a little iPad.
Yeah.
My MacBook is broken. That is an excuse that I'm using. And so I just want to apologize to you, sir, first of all.
He's a newly powerful man.
I know. And you I've arrived with an iPad like I'm a boomer in Europe.
I use my iPad 70% of the time, so I feel insulted by how ashamed you are.
Have you ever gone to a meeting? When you went in to pitch Resident Evil, did it with a fucking iPad in front of you?
No, I did not.
Exactly.
No, I did not.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So
you don't look like a pussy. I mean, it's like
No, he doesn't, Eddie, and you're right. So welcome to Last Podcast on the Left, and we have a very special person on this guy. Honestly, what's funny about this man is that not only is he on his way to becoming an extremely powerful man in Hollywood, and is he becoming a legitimate and crazy director. This man started from the humble beginnings of sketch comedy.
Oh, don't say it!
Just like us. Just like our shit-filled lives. He pulled himself up from the swamp, and he made it to the big time.
What, you think you're better than me?
Yeah,
you think you're fucking tough?
He fucking does.
You think
does.
You know nice with your fancy clear glasses?
This is the director of the new hit, Weapons, and the former hit, current hit, Barbarian.
Woo!
And one of the Lord creatresses of Whitest Kids You Know, Zach Cricker. Thank you for being here.
I'm so thrilled to be here. I love the show, and it's a treat. Thank you so much. Henry, have you talked about how you came in to help me with Barbarian?
Has that only been discussed? Only little pieces is that I came in, and I because I didn't even know what the full extent of my voice was used.
Well, sadly, it wasn't used.
God, that's fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
It was very kind of you to help, though, because what was going on is I was trying to get the scream down for the mother, and I just could not get the scream. And I was listening to your podcast, and you were doing some fucking character, and you just, like, very casually went, like, and then they go, like, and you did this, like, amazing blood-curdling shriek, and I was like, that's what I want. I was like in the car, and I was like, he did it. And so I got a hold of you, and you were so kind to come in, and I made you scream for 20 minutes.
It was awesome.
And it was fun.
It was my pleasure.
It was fun to hang.
Yes, it was my pleasure. No, it was so much fun. I actually, it's a good bring up. So, like, we know each other from way back in the day. Whitest Kids was always held as like this wonderful esteem because when we
the goal.
I'm sure you hated us just like every other sketch group hated
us. You know what, dude? What's nice is that you guys were awesome. Yeah. Each one of you
really?
Was extremely sweet to us. You never made us feel stupid. We were told because we were the only other independent sketch comedy group that when we arrived, we were like a part of a pastiche of independent sketch comedy groups. And like you were like kind of the bastion. You guys were the light on the hill that like, oh, if you're just funny and you're right place, right time, they give you a television show. And then you sealed up the door behind you.
You really did.
Well, that was part of our deal. We're like, close the door.
Yeah, but the part of sketch comedy, I feel like now we even
had Biederman trying to help us for a hot second, and he couldn't do shit.
Right?
He couldn't do shit with us.
He's
either.
So great.
We were a fucking disaster, though. We were hammered.
We were disgusting.
That was the problem.
You think we weren't hammered? Are you kidding?
God damn it! So it couldn't work.
But a lot of people now, like you know, Jordan Peele, a lot of people are they're seeing this connection between horror and comedy, and I think it's getting kind of like everybody's saying sort of the same thing, right? Where that comedy, it hinges on timing and visceral response, which is very similar to humor, but I think it's deeper than that.
Oh, tell me.
Well, no, I wanted to ask you if you felt that exercising dark ideas through sketch comedy actually creates a darker vision for, like, the world in general.
What an amazing question that I have never really considered. And I think you could be right. And here's why I'm going to go with you on this journey here is because all the brainstorming that we would do to sit down and just start like, okay, sketch ideas, you know, because we've all been there like, what would be crazy? You just start pushing your brain to think of like, what's an extreme situation? And I did that all day, every day for I don't know how many fucking years. I committed all of myself to Whitest Kids, basically a decade, yeah, honestly, yep, you know?
Same.
So I think like if there's a gym, you know, like a mental gym, I was working out the muscle group that was like, how far can I go? You know, how can I go left when I should go right? You know, so maybe that's in there. Maybe
plus,
so.
I feel like movies are almost like a series of sketches, like getting you from scene to scene in a weird way.
Do you think that horror movies like comedies hinge on pivotal scenes or versus entire arcs?
Well, that's a great question, too. I think, look, a horror movie must have scenes that scare you, right? If you watch a horror movie and you're never actually scared, but it's telling a great story, it doesn't mean it's a bad movie. It just means it's probably not really a horror movie. You know
what
I mean?
It's a drama.
So, yeah, or it's a mystery. It's a thrill, whatever it is, you know? I don't know. But, I mean, the best horror movies will have those, but they'll still, like, you could take the scares out and it would still tell a compelling story. Like, The Shining is still a fascinating story, even if it wasn't, you know, as viscerally terrifying as it is, because I want to track this guy's decline and I want to watch how his family has to react. I think that's a really engaging story. So I'm trying to think of like a terrifying horror movie where if you took all the scares out, it would be like, let's examine Terrifier 2. Right?
Yeah, okay. Sure. Yeah. Terrifier 2, okay. Which is like, for me, I view that even closer to like a comedy in terms of you have set pieces. Like Terrifier 2 has set pieces that the movie is sort of moving towards that allow these things to collide. Where like you did that so well in Weapons with the kind of way you told the story where you set four lines out at each other and then they all collide together.
Yeah.
But Terrifier 2 is a much more deeply simplified version of what you did. You know, like it's a much more simplified, it's much more direct. It obviously is like, we got to kill a bunch of people. Like, you know, like Terrifier 2, you know, the idea is to get just piles of guts.
Yeah. That is, yeah, you know, yeah, it's yeah. Just, it's just yeah. kill, you know.
By the way, I really like Terrifier 2.
I am
a big fan. When I went to Fright Fest in 2022, the only movie I was like, I gotta clear my schedule to go see Terrifier 2. Because I loved Terrifier 1, and I was like, I can't believe I had to wait like this many years to see this fucking thing. I am ready. So
I was
I'm into it.
Dude, I mainlined all of them at once, just because I was literally scared to see him. Yeah. Because I'm like, I don't know if I can handle all this gore. And then so I was just like, then we interviewed David Howard Thornton. So I just watched all three like right in a row. And that was that's the way to do it.
And he's the simplest little cowpoke Southern boy. Have you ever talked to him?
No.
Art the Clown?
No.
Oh, God.
He's all like, well, gee golly, I don't even know how all this happened. I'm just a theater boy, and I love musicals, and it's amazing, honestly.
Yeah.
Last night, I had the pleasure of seeing Weapons in a packed theater. Wednesday night, packed theater.
Tuesday night, I saw it in a packed theater, and not just that, it was playing in multiple theaters at once, and it was like everyone was going to see Weapons. It was fucking awesome.
That's wild.
But the reaction, dude. There was a part in this that I wondered.
People were talking in the lobby.
Oh, yes. Everybody was hanging out in the lobby. You have such a great, like, when you were making this movie, you ever see Exorcist 3? Did you put Exorcist 3 in this?
Of course I've seen Exorcist 3. I think it's amazing.
Were you inspired at all by Exorcist 3? Because I think you have one of the best jump scares that I've seen in a fucking minute. Dead in
I'm
the
guessing
right.
You're talking about the ceiling.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, that's got to come from Exorcist 3, but that's kind of a combination of three jump scares. Obviously, the Exorcist 3 ceiling gag is not a jump scare. It's just deeply off-putting.
Yes.
You know, it's great. It's mesmerizing, and I love it. The Exorcist 3 jump scare, which is for my money in the top five of all time, is the hallway crash zoom on that fucking lady with the scissors. That, to me, I'm getting the hair on my neck is standing up right now. Hell yeah. Just thinking about that scare, it's so good. I don't know how it freaked me out so much the first time I saw it, and it's one of those scares where I could still put it on right now and it would still kind of get me, you know. I love it so much. The other one, and this is a little less like hip cred here, but The Conjuring, dude, the Bathsheba on top of the armoire when it tilted up and she jumps, I was not ready for that, dude. That annihilated me in the theater.
Dude, the first Conjuring fucked me up. It was the best.
Dude, the clapping sequence, it's ruthless.
I always think of Insidious too, though, which is my other big commercial one where I almost killed my mother because I knew it was coming. I knew we saw it with my mom, and I knew the devil, the fire devil scene was coming. And so I crawled.
Where it's like over the shoulder?
Yes, yeah. I crawled behind the chair that she was sitting in. I pretended to go to the bathroom and I crawled behind the chair, and as it popped up, I almost fucking killed her. It was great. Man, it was so worth it.
But I do believe that's an Insidious 1, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, Insidious. Yeah. That's my other favorite jump scare. But, like, when you're thinking about the movie, when you're writing it, like, do you think about it in that way? Like, for those jump scares, for stuff like that, like, because in Weapons, it came at a very specific moment, obviously. It felt like it almost felt like the movie kicks in hard. Like you were watching and all of a sudden it was like the movie changed. Is that on purpose?
To a degree, yeah. So my writing process is usually very stream of consciousness. I don't outline. I don't know where I'm going to go. So, like, I remember the first pass I did at that point in Justine's chapter, I actually didn't really know where the kids went. I didn't know what was behind them running away. So I was kind of like just like improvising. And so I don't think I put that ceiling scene nightmare in because I didn't know that Gladys existed.
Yeah.
And so
when did Gladys show up for you?
I think in the cop stuff, when I was getting into Paul and the cop and the junkie is when I kind of figured it out. So, like, I think by the time I wrote James's chapter, I had that idea. I was like, the kids are in the basement. Why, though? Like, why would the kids be in Alex's basement? It just felt like that's where they had to be. And then I just kind of had this idea of, like, this is going to sound really woo-woo, and I really don't like to talk about the meaning of the movie, but I have said this before, so I guess I can let this much out of the bag because it's already out. But, like, the Gladys and Alex chapter to me is just about living with an alcoholic parent. I grew up in an alcoholic household. My dad died of cirrhosis, you know, and it's a terrible thing that comes into a family dynamic, and it changes everything. And so, you know, I had a happy house, and then something came into my house and it turned my dad into a scary person, and I'd go to school and everything's cool, and I'd go home and I'd have a scary house with a scary dad, you know? And so, like, that to me felt so interesting, and this is such a personal movie, so it's like there's no overarching, like, lesson in this movie. This is not, like, I have nothing to say with this movie. I have no pretense of, like, this is a treatise or anything like that. It's just a diary entry for me. And it just felt good to kind of have this dynamic at the core of it. That is something that I feel really a personal connection to that had a ripple effect out into this town.
Dude.
And so that's all that is.
I gotta say, because that came off of the movie, like, watching it, I did not read any of your interviews leading up to it. I had no idea. I didn't even see a trailer. I didn't know what the movie was about.
It's the best way to go in.
It's my favorite. And so I went and watched it. And the first thing that one of my first reactions that came off when I saw it was, there's so many allegorical layers within this story that can be applied that you wonder if it came from something personal. Like, it felt like it, because it definitely feels like they're all, it feels like there's a lesson to be learned here, but we have no idea what it is. And everybody that's a responsible person inside of the movie is also like, there's a lesson to be learned here. What's the fucking lesson?
Yeah.
And they can't figure it out.
They all do what they think is right, and it just doesn't work out, man. It's fucking weird.
Yeah. I've definitely been kind of cognizant of some of the, there's a lot of theories out there about what this movie's trying to say.
Oh, and yeah, what is sure. The That's gun. The best part.
And you know, yeah.
Yeah, what's with the AK-47? Can I ask, what's with the AK? Was it just elemental? Like, is it just a...
If I gave you the answer, I would be robbing something precious.
Great.
And it's like, you know what I mean? So it's like...
Dude, you're crushing it, man. That's what I was saying. Yeah. It's like, I think that's the idea, is that that's what we liked about David Lynch, is the fact that he didn't give a fuck about answering the question. He doesn't care to answer the question.
That's exactly what Julie and I, my wife and I, said as soon as we left. It's like, I hate when fucking movies, especially horror movies, sit there and they kind of over-explain everything. Let my brain torture itself. And it was amazing.
some things in this movie, I don't know why they're in the movie. I genuinely don't understand them. And but because I do a David, I read David Lynch's book, Catching the Big Fish, right? Which is about transcendental meditation as a creative tool. Ever since I read that book, I incorporated transcendental meditation into my writing process. I wrote Barbarian that way. I wrote Weapons that way. And part of the deal for me is if that's going to be my process, I want to go, I want to like do it all the way. And so there's things that come into my writing that I don't quite get, but I love them. And I maybe I love them because I don't quite get them. And sometimes I'll write shit in and it'll be a couple of years go by and then I'll actually realize what it means. And it's like, I must have known it all along, but I didn't quite crack the code until later. And to me, that is like so, I just think that's so wonderful. It's just such a fun part of being a creative person is to just like tap into something outside of yourself and try and be a conduit, you know, whether it's real or not, or I'm just deluding myself isn't even important to me. But the idea of like feeling like an antenna is wonderful. Chekhov, kind of, that was his thing. He would give that advice to actors. He'd be like, creativity and good ideas don't come from you. They come from outside. And your only job is to like tap into the frequency and receive them from without. And I just think that like, why can't that be the case? You know, I like to pretend that that's the way.
And it's also about experiencing, maybe, I don't know if it's just getting older in a way sometimes too. I wonder if it's being able to almost accept the mystery of yourself.
Yeah. I mean, David Lynch went a step further. He said that ideas are out there waiting to be caught. And if you don't catch it, somebody else will. And that's a really fascinating thing where it's like these, and I like to think of it like he says, catching the big fish. I like to think you go down under the ocean and there are these big fish swimming around and I can hook them. But if I don't, that story's going to get told one way or another. You know,
like
time comes for these things. You know, that's why sometimes we get a lot of similar things that all seem to kind of come out at the same time.
So right now you're in Prague shooting Resident Evil. How's the human trafficking going, by the way?
Yeah.
It's been okay. I could use more.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Same. Yeah.
Also, it's not bumper to bumper.
No.
Not there. Yeah, yeah. Now, my question is that, but now you're shooting, so speaking of process, so you go from this smaller process with, obviously you got a little bit more money with Weapons, but it was like, it's still all you and it's an independent movie and it allows for that. With something like Resident Evil, when you're handed something that is this like kind of a blanket IP, do they give you that same level of trust, or like is it a whole different way of making movies?
I'm in a very fortunate position with this movie where I have the same amount of control that I had for Weapons.
Yeah. Really?
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I have Final Cut. You know, I wrote the script, and this is the movie I'm making, and everyone is in. So it's a very, very fortunate position to be in.
Did you have to change your brain in how you write movies in terms of like, is it a different type of movie than what you've made already?
Okay, so, well, it's a totally different type of movie, but I wrote it, like, way before I went and did Weapons. So, and it was funny because I wrote it kind of, like, carelessly because I was like, I'm never going to direct Resident Evil, so I'm just going to fucking write, like, I'm just going to have fucking fun. I'm just going to, like, play around and just be like, what if this happened? Oh, my God, they'll never let me. What if this happened? And by the time I finished, I was like, oh, my God, I fucking love it. You know, and by the way, I think that is the other real special key to creativity is to be careless and to, like, have no regard for the result and play like a little kid colors with crayons, right?
Yeah, you can always
edit
later.
If you do that with, like, yeah, exactly. Like, Kurt Vonnegut has that amazing lesson. He's like, dude, you know, Kurt Vonnegut, how he always starts everything like, yo, dude.
Hey, bro. Yeah, it's good.
Listen, check it. No, but he would say, you know, write three sentences on a piece of paper and know that as soon as you're done, you're going to burn the paper. And I promise you, you will fall in love with what you write. And that is because there is no result expectation.
Yes.
And so it's just this pure thing. And so if you're able to get yourself in a position where you can write from a place of joy and of fun and of carelessness, then that's when the best stuff comes out. And so because I already knew I was going to make Weapons and I didn't really give a shit about, you know, Resident Evil, I thought at the time, I was able to just write just from a pure, like, this would be so fun. And then I ended up with something I was like in love with. So now I get to go make another movie that I think is going to be like such a blast. So it's cool.
Are you working with the original writers of Resident Evil, or how do they feel about it? No? Do they even know what you're doing?
I don't know.
Hell yeah.
Man. Yeah, no, he can't be saddled with that. He can't be afraid of what the video game people are going to do. Video game.
By the way, I love those games.
Sure, obviously, you wrote the thing for fun. Yeah. You know, of course you love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, Resident Evil 4, I've probably put, like, 7,000 fucking hours into just that game alone. It's, like, embarrassing. So I mean, I'm writing this as a true fan, and I want it to feel like the way that I feel when I play those games.
Do you go back and literally play Resident Evil, like, in your room? Like, will you go to your room and play it and then go back and
My PS5 comes with me wherever I go. I'm not joking.
Hell yeah.
And I play every day.
Of course.
I don't play Resident Evil every day, but I play, you know, I'm a big video game guy. It's my only vice, really. It's like
What are you playing right now?
Right now I'm playing two things. I'm playing the new Mafia game that came out this week, which it's cool. And I'm replaying for like the fifth time Tiny Tina's Wonderland because I'm so excited for Borderlands 4 to come out next month.
That's amazing. Wow, that's right. Yeah. You see, this is good. It's a peek inside.
I love you working at the idea of you making Resident Evil and then going back to your hotel room and playing more Resident Evil.
I do it.
When I was a cook, I used to go home and play Burger Time, you know? So I was like, it's like... So I understand.
Hell yeah, dude.
Should we want to ask any, do we want to do a little, let me do a spoil, you want to do any spoiler questions, maybe? Yeah.
All right, sure.
Unless there's any other, like, generals before we get in there, because that's my problem. We have so many questions about weapons.
Yes.
But I don't want people to, we got to go see weapons.
Man, first off,
Dude, it's so funny. I was trying to get you guys to come over to my house to watch. I know you couldn't make it. I know, but it's just like, by the way, my wife and I are both such huge fans. So the idea that like you guys would come over and watch it, like I would never offer anybody that.
Oh,
but Sarah and I were just like, and they'll come and we'll make it real nice. And we'll
were very
and
excited
chips.
Too. We were doing the same way.
We worked the same.
But Henry's dad had to fucking die.
Yeah, my father had to kick the fucking bucket.
Fucking asshole.
It's all right, dude. No, he fucking
everything. One more fuck.
It did actually hurt my summer schedule. And I did talk with my father's ghost. It's going to destroy so I can.
Well, Barbarian, first off, before we go any further onto weapons, Barbarian, like, blew me away. I didn't know it was you when I went and saw it. I went and saw it by accident. Like, I was like, I'll check out this weird movie, you know? And I went and I fucking lost my mind. I was, like, cheering. I was like, Barbarian and weapons, like, both. When I walked out of there, I was like, jealous. You know, I was it was one of those. I was like, God damn, fucking did it, you piece of shit. Motherfucker. It was so good, man. I really loved it. I was rewatching it last night before I came here. And I just love, we were talking about this, how you just like blow up everything constantly.
Yeah, your endings just blow the fuck up.
And it just makes me so happy, man. It's like, oh, you want a sequel? Fuck yourself. You know? I just wanted to gush about Barbarian for 2 seconds.
I'll take it. I'd love to hear it.
What is happening? You know what's great? Because I feel like we're finally entering the world of modern horror movies where people aren't writing it from the aspect of like cell phones and the internet are a fad.
Yeah.
I feel like you're finally embracing this. What we were like, my wife and I were talking about last night about the idea of like almost like an urban fairy tale where it's like it's taking place within a believable environment. Like when you were working on Barbarian, Detroit obviously had a lot to do with the movie. When you were shooting this movie on weapons, it feels like I've heard several critics already say the idea of Stephen King-like. Right, you've seen the Stephen King like, and both Natalie and I both said the same thing, oddly enough, as soon as I was watching. And I was like, that's where Pennywise lives. Like, as soon as I saw that bridge, I was like, that's where Pennywise lives. 217 is all in the Stephen King world. And is that overt or is that subtle? Is that like on the inside?
It's not intentionally, but, you know, I don't think you could be our age and grow up in America and have an interest in horror and not be totally baked by Stephen King.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it's unavoidable. So I loved, you know, I read it in junior high and I fucking loved it. So, yeah, it's I'd be a total liar if I was like, no, man, there's no Stephen King in this. Because it's like the Beatles. It's like, it's everywhere. It's
there's Beatles in it, too. Right up top, man.
Yeah, dude, how'd you get the George Harrison song?
Oh, look at your shirt. Oh, fuck yeah, dude.
Yeah, dude, how did you get that song? What dude, a great just, moment, dude.
I was so happy. I'm just singing. I was like, peace. I was like, I ate a little mushroom pill. I was like,
yeah, I love that fucking song. That song is so good, dude. I mean, we got it. We just had to pay out the ass.
Yeah, dude, I've been listening to All Things Must Pass ever since I saw the movie, like, just over and over
again. Perfect
album. It really is.
The music is, it was, how specific, and how involved were you in choosing the music for the movie? Because
I mean, he wrote a bunch of it.
Yeah. I scored it with my two like best friends.
Yeah, the Halliday brothers or something.
The Halliday brothers. Yeah, yeah. So Ryan and Hayes, they're like two dudes I grew up with in Arlington, Virginia. We were in a band in college, and they're really talented musicians. And we just share a musical mind because we've made music together for so long. And when I was doing Barbarian, I was just kind of like, I just realized like if I could do this with Ryan and Hayes, it would just be so like psychic, you know, mind meld easy. And so on this one, they had never scored a movie before. I'd never scored a movie before, but I was just like, I want to just try this. And the studio was cool. And so, yeah, I just brought my, like, my best buds to New York and we just did it. It was great.
What is that process like, honestly? Like, when do you, is the movie already cut and finalized by the time you're doing that?
We did it weird because before I went to Atlanta and shot the movie, I got together with Ryan and Hayes and we went through the script and we scored the movie. So like we wrote like all this music like for each scene. And so when I was shooting, I kind of had an idea of like, you know, how it was going to feel, which was really helpful. And then when I was editing it, they came out and a lot of that stuff didn't make it in the movie, but some of it did. And I didn't temp anything. So they were just there. And as I'm cutting the movie together, I'd cut with my editor. I'd go in the room with them and then we'd start doing the music. And I'd go back with my editor, do some cutting. And so we were able to just kind of stitch the picture cut and the score together simultaneously. So I never,
that's cool.
You know, they kind of informed each other. It was really cool.
But also the music, the song choices were all like elementally in the same, like it was a very specific vibe. Like it was like that.
Yeah.
Like, and is that
like
just
Beware of Darkness and the Percy Sledge are in the script. I knew I wanted the Handsome Family song like while we were shooting. And then that MGMT song at the very end, good. I knew I wanted that like from the very beginning. So,
I love that band. I never heard that song before. It's
perfect. Off of their Live at the Guggenheim album is amazing. And hell it is just as good as some of their studio albums. So I highly recommend it.
I feel like that's one of those things that also just either raises a movie up or destroys it.
Yes.
Is the soundscape in that way of like choosing. Because it really, there's something about your song choices that made it feel like the suburbs. It made it feel like a place that's safe. You know what I mean? Like a place that like you're in a safe place. You're being held by this like warm, understanding music, but it's obviously an extremely unpredictable world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just loved it. Fucking you. Great work, bro.
Yeah.
Great bro.
Thank you so much.
Also, totally dug the Steamboat Willie, you know, usage.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's crazy, right? Because this is the year that like Steamboat Willie came up for public domain. And so my costume designer was like, we can do this. And you're it like, won't be like totally played out. And I was like, well, let's fucking
go. Fuck yeah, dude.
It was awesome, man. Just watching him go around fucking covered in blood. Dude, all right. So spoiler zone, I guess.
Yeah. Let's just so you know, we're going to ask some specific questions about weapons. Just go see fucking Weapons.
Yes, please go see this movie. I had so much fun. People were cheering and clapping during the movie.
Dude, one of the biggest kudos I can give to the movie. We were sitting next to two teenagers that were trying to fucking have sex with each other the entire time. I could definitely, they were hammered and they were trying to have sex with each other. They stopped to watch the movie.
Wow.
It doesn't get better than that. That is as good as it gets. Baby.
Only half penetration, man. They couldn't go all the way.
And then I was like, let me show you. hey, let me show you what to do. This is what my father did for me.
Oh, man. All right. So Benedict Wong was fucking awesome. It was a great choice having him in the movie. Yeah. The eyeballs. How the hell did you do the eyeballs? Was that CGI or was that makeup?
Yeah, it's
or
VFX.
Like, it's VFX?
It's VFX.
Man, I thought he could do that.
That's good. That's great. I'm glad you thought that.
It looked real as hell.
Yeah, it's crazy because what we did is like, so, you know, they scan his face and then they build his face in the computer, right? It's like these artists like meticulously build it. And then they basically create this like system where I could go in and look at the cut and then they had a little slider that would just do the bulge and the size of the eyeball so they could just go like all the way up and it looked like fucking insane. Whoa. Roger Rabbit, or like back down. And so it was really fun to kind of like, you know, let's try it at a 5.2. Ooh, awesome. That's crazy. Let's try it at a 6.1. You know, it was really wild. It was so fun.
That's awesome, dude. When it came to the magical practices of your, is it fair to say you could maybe call Weapons almost like a witch movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yes. And when you built out her specific, because also Amy Madigan.
Holy amazing, fucking right?
shit. Terrifying.
Holy shit, dude.
Yeah.
Holy
fucking shit. She's fucked up.
She's got to get her teeth fixed.
Yeah, she's got therapy.
Yeah, she's all fucked up. But it's like when she was making her the magical practices and all the stuff that she was doing, are you, like, did you have a firm idea of what it was that she was doing? Did you and Amy have a long conversation? Or was that, like, just kind of like, let's play it like it was, like, you know, like, you know, but nobody else has to know?
You mean in terms of the rituals that she was doing?
Yes.
No. That I worked out way in advance. And that was actually pretty complicated to try and get it, because it has to, like, serve different functions in different scenes, but it has to stay consistent. So that was something I worked on with my production designer, Tom Hammock, and I. We really kind of, like, ironed out together how the ritual would go. And that was fun to kind of create your own magic rituals. There's a Mekons, you know, there's this punk band, the Mekons, and they have this song called Dancing in the Head. And it's just about, it's instructions on how to create a zombie using like voodoo. And it's fucking awesome. And I was going to call the movie Dancing in the Head at one point. And it just the idea of like soak a dollar bill in rum and then light it on fire and have four windows that aim at the four corners of the earth. All this, I just love that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And there's this great book called Serpent in the Rainbow, which is it's like a nonfiction book about, you know, Haitian magic and stuff like that.
Great movie too.
I didn't want to use real stuff, but it was such a fun opportunity to create my own, you know, rituals. So like I invented that tree and the idea of like, you know, it's all kind of adjacent to existing magic practices, but it's fake, you know.
No, I recognized it, honestly, and I really appreciated it. She was never related to them, was she?
I don't know. Come on.
Fuck yourself.
That's
but I do think it's fascinating that the way she describes her relationship is different from the way that Whitmer Thomas describes her.
Exactly. He's like, so we saw her one time when she 15 years ago, and then the other one was like, I don't know if I've ever met her. I was just like, that's fun. That was a great.
Yeah.
When it came to Gladys's look, was that a long conversation? Was that a conversation between you and Amy and the production? Or was that, did you have to like convince Amy to not look like that?
No, Amy
did she
is so
just
down.
Arrive like that?
She's dead. No.
Yeah.
I was like, Amy, can we kind of like dial it down a little bit? She's like, nope, in for a penny, in for a pound. So yeah, her look is based off of in Twin Peaks, Firewalk with Me, when he gets out of the plane and there's that woman on the tarmac. That scared the fucking shit out of me.
Yeah, scared
me so bad. So I was just like, that is always kind of in my mind. And then the photographer Cindy Sherman, who I've always adored. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she does these self portraits and she uses prosthetics to create this like uncanny valley asymmetrical look. And she's always like photographing herself looking grotesque. And it's awesome. So I knew I wanted to incorporate some of that. And then there's just like that Boca Raton, old retiree kind of fashion sense that I just think is so great. And so Trish Somerville, who is my costume designer, and Jason Collins, my makeup designer, we had a wonderful time figuring out how to like build Gladys. It was great.
I love it because it's obvious Gladys is trying to figure out how to fit in. Right?
I like the idea of like Anton Chigurh, you know, like how he's like, he's just kind of impersonating what he sees around him. So
yes,
he's got
he's
that
nothing.
Fucking stupid haircut and his clothes are too clean. It's like he went into a Western store and just like didn't look too hard. And he's just kind of like, he's impersonating something.
Yeah, he's I like a hitman, but he's like, also a demon. Yeah.
I'm not saying that Gladys is a demon, but I like the idea that it's just like, it's just off, you know? And that's what's so fun.
Did you get any trouble from the Naruto people?
I'm in litigation now with them, and it's very ugly. Yeah.
Is there any... how is that going? Because it's hard. I do understand, especially after the Area 51 incident. Yeah. People get pretty sensitive about running styles. I was like, honestly, that was pretty fucking awesome. That's like, what a great visual. When you're writing it, Like, is that one of those things that you just kind of saw immediately?
Yes.
Like the way that they were, like the way, because they're fleeing like almost like birds. They're running like, it's such a beautiful picture.
And in the script, I think what I wrote, I know, was they run like the way that, it's a terrible image, but that little girl in the, that famous Vietnamese war photograph with the napalm.
That cements it though.
Yeah.
It's like the worst image I've ever seen.
Yeah,
it is. And it really fucked me up a bit. And so, I think that was in there.
Dude, that it just, because it really, it serves. It serves the work. Like, it's really amazing just hearing you talk about how much was both happenstance and mixed with planning and stuff. Like, it really shows that, like, movies are little miracles.
They are absolutely little miracles. Every single one of them is.
You know,
yes,
like,
they are.
The fact that you could put it all together, the fact that all of these things happen and they all, like, but I think that partially it's because you delivered a great lesson to our audience about the idea of getting out of your own way. And just making it, like playing it as it lays. You're going to make it as it comes out.
I think that's a really healthy practice, you know. And it's that David Lynch thing. It's like you go inside of yourself to receive something from outside of yourself. You know, it's like counterintuitive, but I think it's a real thing. And
because you aren't like an autocratic monster on set. You're not all like,
I don't think
that's
so.
In the goddamn movie. I don't care. Like, is it one of those where,
No, I try not to. I mean, I want everyone to have a better idea than me because then the movie gets that much better. You know what I mean? So,
One thing I really dug was like the tiny details that kind of like were misdirects. You know, you think it really, to me anyway, maybe I'm an idiot and it did mean something and I didn't think it did, but like, like the people drinking and stuff, you think like, you know, the relationship between the cop and Julia Gardner, you know, like I love all that stuff. And it kind of just like, and then it just becomes like, it just, at the end of the movie, none of it matters. And I thought it was,
I've heard that worded as a criticism of the movie. I appreciate that for you that's a good thing, but
I think that is one of the things people don't like. It fucks up my brain, like, because like, I'm going one way and then all of a sudden it's like, oh shit, it's this, you know. And it's like, I like that.
No, it's about how everybody in the movie is willing to blame anybody else but the actual problem. Like, that's how it feels. Everybody's looking for a very simplified answer to a question that literally there is no answer to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how I viewed it, where it's like you have all these people that desperately want to help. The cop wants to help. You know, like Julie wants to help. They want to help. They're like, even Josh Brolin, what is it like working with a movie star like that?
It's wild because like Josh is, first of all, he's very cool. Like he's a very chill, like disarming, funny kind of, he's a good hang, you know? Yeah. So I'd kind of gotten to know him a bit before we started shooting. So I you know, I was starstruck when I first met him because it's like Josh fucking Brolin, like No Country for Old Men. Like what, I don't even know what to say. But you know, he's very, very good at quickly kind of disarming you. And so by the time, you know, we were like having our first day on set, I didn't, you know, he's just Josh, you know, it's like, it's easy. But I remember I'm looking at the monitor and he stepped in front of the camera and I'm watching it on screen. And I had like a real like, holy shit, it's Josh Brolin. You know, it's like, it's a moment. And I felt like so fortunate in that moment. I get to have this for the whole fucking movie
all the time.
It's crazy.
Like, what is that difference? Because I see me on camera, I'm like, oh god. But then when you see a like that, like what makes a movie star? Like, well, what is it about it?
It's a big head. First of all, you gotta have a big head.
A big head helps. Josh has a big
Black,
head.
Jack Black literally has the largest dome I've ever seen on a person.
Humphrey Bogart, giant. He was like half head.
I have no idea what it is, but it's like every angle, there's just something that you're interested in. You know, there's something you can't quite figure it out, but you're just drawn in. I don't know what it is, dude.
And maybe it's just like
that's a real thing, though.
And that mystery is what sometimes turns them into like weird when they turn into like, you know, like weird MAGA dudes. Is that what happens to like the older movie guys sometimes? Because they're like, I used to be interesting.
I think they were always
like John Voight.
Yeah,
John Voight, James Woods.
I used to make love to my daughter every day.
I think think there's a reason they were such good bad guys all the time. You know, like they were
bad men.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah. Josh Brolin, I love how in the movie, like they all like they're against each other, and then it just shows in society you just need that one thing to happen, and then all of a sudden we're on the same team. And like,
yeah, so all you need is a bulging-eyed zombie man to physically attack a woman, and then you're willing to jump right
needs
in.
To be, yes, a common enemy is usually an attack is what'll do it, right?
All right. So at the risk of asking this because I don't want you to like you know do it, what did Josh Brolin do as a producer? I noticed he was a producer. What is that? Is that, you know, like, I'm just curious.
That's a little bit of movie magic.
That's a little bit of movie magic. You know, like, he was helpful with, like, helping with some schedule stuff. And he's helpful in, like, helping us, like, make sure that we had the other cast that we needed.
Season 4 for Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, when I did the Adult Swim show, they gave me my producer credit. And I legitimately felt like they just gave me a sash. And then I sat in a chair. Like, I sat in a chair. I had my own, like, my own ear set. But that's, like, all it was. I was like, I'm a producer. They're like, yeah. Definitely.
So funny, dude. Oh, my God.
It's just the truth. Dude, thank you so fucking much for taking time out of your busy day. I know you're working like a goddamn maniac right now. Thank you so much for talking to us, man.
Yeah, man.
You guys, this was so fun. I'm so happy to do it. I've been really looking forward to this.
Just go get your ass to Weapons.
Go see this movie in the theater. It has to be seen in the theater with a crowd. You're going to have the best time checking this movie out. Bring a crew. Bring your friends. You're all going to talk about this movie forever.
Old-fashioned gasps and laughter in a film.
Yeah, I can't.
Good great work, man. Gasps. Like, people screaming. Like, literally, dude, people screaming.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
You did it,
you
dude.
Got that That's jump great. Scare. I literally went, oh, oh, oh. I went like, oh. Like, I yelled.
Hell you yeah. know what sucks? I'm in fucking Prague, dude. And Prague is beautiful and wonderful. But, like, I wasn't in America for the release of the movie. And I went to go see it opening weekend in Prague at a mall near here. And it was fucking empty. And
no
I was just
one
like,
cares.
God, man. I feel like something cool is happening right now. And I'm just
you
like.
You should just be barking outside the theater. Just be like, hey, what for
that's my goddamn movie. Yeah. Well, don't worry. I'm out here telling people I'm you.
Yeah.
And celebrating your success. Don't. Don't worry, I'm the director of this film. I say that quite often. I'm used to saying that. Zach Cregger, thank you so much, and fucking good luck on Resident Evil.
Yeah, man, go
thank
rip the cock off a zombie for us.
Yeah,
today.
Go punch Andrew Tate's cousin for me.
Okay, can we do this again when Rez is done? Can we do this again?
Of course,
anything,
okay, anytime.
I just want to hang. Right. Be honest.
Yeah, you know? We'll hang out too. We'll just do like an actual social.
Can we be friends?